This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Yes, indeed. Welcome to the show. And before we get to our guest this week, I wanted to get to a couple of other things. One of those is I tend to be behind on answering emails. And I know a bunch of you have written me, and I've been meaning to write people back, and I have not done it. I do try to answer everyone, and I still am collecting stories for our listener stories shows. It's definitely going to be more than one show at this point. So if I haven't gotten back to you, don't feel that I'm ignoring you, because I am not. People have written me some very interesting things that I fully intend on responding to. It's just a matter of remembering to do so. So sooner or later, you will hear back from me. Feel free to pester me if you wanted something that I didn't get back to you on. I'm just a little bit overwhelmed sometimes. All right. So tonight, we have also, I should mention, we have a midweek podcast up with Joshua Cutchin and Michael Hughes talking about what it constitutes paranormal evidence. This is part two of that, where we delve into some of the stuff we missed the first time, and we also kind of turn the tables and look at why science is allowed to accept certain things without evidence. All right. So our guest tonight is Mr. Scotty Roberts. You there, Scotty?
I certainly am, Soraya.
All right. And we don't know where John is.
John is lost somewhere in Florence, Italy.
All right. So if John Ward shows up at some point, we'll feed him in, and we'll add him to the conversation.
Right on.
But for now, we have you. And it's been a while since you've been on.
It certainly has. I hear you all the time because you're on our network, the IPBN, Alternative Talk Radio Network. And so I hear you all the time, but we haven't talked in a long time.
So you have this small thing coming up in October.
Yes.
The Paradigm Symposium.
Yes, indeed. This will be our fourth year doing the Paradigm Symposium, although it seems forever. It's been a part of my life for 4 years. So it's we started in 2012, and I remember it was a good friend of yours and mine, Micah Hanks, and we actually conceived this thing, and it was we were sitting. I was talking to him on my cell phone from standing in the driveway and getting some fresh air, and we were talking. He says, "You know, brother, we ought to do an event." And this was back in early 2012. As a matter of fact, it was late 2011. And we were going to gear it toward the whole 2012 thing in December of 2012. And I said, you know, let's avoid all that nonsense. Why don't we go a couple months earlier? And I think Micah came up with the name something like the Intrepid Magazine Graylian Report End of the World Bash.
And that's awesome.
I said, I think, Micah, that's a little wordy. And at the time, when we came up with Paradigm Symposium, we had been talking about mostly ufology and the paradigm shift that had been going on, it seemed, in ufology, going from kind of that old school to new school thinking and research. And I said, you know, we've got a lot of ufologists coming to the first we hadn't invited any ufologists yet, but we geared it around that and said, let's just call it the Paradigm Symposium. And it's stuck, and now it's more cliche, the word paradigm, than it ever has been in the history of the word, I think.
Yeah, pretty
but,
much. I still think it's a good name for the whole thing.
Ah, thank you. But what we really wanted to do was, the goal was to try to bridge the gap between alternative and academic points of view. And That's a little harder than we originally thought it would be, because you get bristling from both sides. But I remember saying to Micah about the symposium part, I said, well, how hard could it be? I said, we just get a hotel and we invite some speakers and we sell tickets and then we make some money. And we kind of chuckled about that. And hopefully one of these years we'll actually make a little something we can put in the bank and say, hey, let's have a celebration dinner. When it's over. So we started that first year with the entire cast of Ancient Aliens. When I say the entire cast, I'm talking about, you know, your top four or five names.
Right.
We had Eric Von Daniken, Giorgio Tsoukalos, Philip Coppens, George Norrie. We had Bill Burns, but then Bill Burns had to drop out about a week ahead of the event. And then we had lots of pundits and writers that you're very familiar with. And a handful of those have been our staple every year. We've got this foundation of people who have been with us every year, like Laird Scranton, Nick Redfern. Who else has been a staple? Well, John Ward and me and Micah. These have been pretty much this handful of people that have been with us every year. And Micah is an integral part of everything we do. And so we just wanted to have an event that was, I said, I want this to be worthwhile. I want it to be something where people can come and, let me backtrack just a second to preface what I'm going to say. There's a lot of people out there that would contact us over the years and say, are you going to broadcast this on the internet? Can I pick it up? Is it going to be streamed? And I kind of sat back for a minute and I thought and I went, no, it's not going to be streamed. There might be money to be made doing that, some people might say. But I think that there is intrinsic value in sitting at the feet of great thinkers. And, of course, who is a great thinker may be redefined from person to person or group to group.
Sure.
But the people that we've had, it's ranged from whether you like him or not, like his theories or not, an Eric Von Daniken, to, and Georgius Tsoukalos, the TV rock stars, the personalities kind of. We've had Scott Walter from America Unearthed in the 2013. We've had Robert Bavall a couple of years in a row, Dr. Robert Schock, many speakers that seem to cover those topics. And so I say, we have this as a show so you can sit live and sit at the, in a sense, it's like sitting at the feet of Socrates. Do you want to stream that or would you want to be there? And I don't know, maybe Socrates was a shrewd businessman and would have said, you fools, you should be streaming it and making some money. That's what we've always done with it. That's the way we viewed it. It's worthwhile. It means something. There's value to it. And I'm so close to it that I see the value of it up front. To other people out there, some might think, oh, it's just another event to attend. To me, it's an event above events because I'm putting it together, and so I'm very close to it. But I know Philip Coppens, who came the first year, and he was dead within 2 months of that event. He passed away in December of 2012. But he had said in the meantime, in between, he said the Paradigm Symposium has quickly become the number one alternative conference in the United States, if not the world.
Nice.
And that was his take on the 2012. And that's what we were looking for. I said to Micah when we first put the symposium together, I said, I want people, when I know I'll be very happy, I want people to, as they're leaving, looking back at the door of the hotel and saying, man, I can't wait till next year. And that's really the atmosphere we've tried to build with everybody. And there's this, not just the sitting at the feet of the thinkers, but there is also the sitting with each other. The after hours at the Paradigm Symposium has become just as phenomenal as the stage portion of it. Because every night, everybody sits up in those hotels. It's evolved into people are playing music and bringing their instruments, and all the speakers are pretty much, most of them, show up to the after hours, and we all sit and have drinks and talk and go from circle to circle to circle, And we do radio shows live from there, and it's just been a phenomenal experience.
Nice. I would only say, from my personal perspective, I can't actually attend. So if you streamed it, that would be cool.
Yeah, I know that there are some people who just can't attend. And I get that, and I understand that.
Someday, maybe. It is my, if I'm going to go to any of these different events, Paradigm is number one on my list.
Well, thank you very much.
It's just a matter of actually being able to do it, and at this point, I can't.
I understand that, and not everybody can come to this. You know, we average usually about 400-ish people that come to this event. I would love to pack it out. It would be nice to say we had 2,000 people show up, and if we had 2,000 people show up and we're not just scraping to break even every year, it would be nice to say we've got dollars in the bank as a business that says we can do better next year. We can do better things and cooler things. And that's one thing I, if you don't mind, I'm going to address, because I've run into this a couple of times where people on the social networks, you'll get somebody that'll say, oh, I see another event for the rich. And I said, are you kidding me? I said, this thing only costs $280 and for 4 days. And I said, yeah, you've got to get a hotel and airfare if you don't live here. I said, so yes, it can be an expensive endeavor. I said, but at the same time, we believe that there is intrinsic value to this. And these things cost a hell of a lot of money to put together. And the average budget for the Paradigm Symposium to get all our speakers here, we have speakers coming from around the world. Some of them have high honorariums. Some of them have none. Which is kind of cool, but we end up anywhere from $60,000 to $80,000 every year to sign. And so we get some sponsorships, but we also charge a decent price. It's not a $42 event. It costs a little bit because it costs a lot to put it on. And we hope we deliver the best show for people. So that's one of the things I've had to deal with, the business side of this. It's like, I don't know, it's like publishing a book anymore. If you publish a book, your publisher wants to see return on that book. If they don't see return on the investment they put into it, you may not get another book deal.
Yeah, well.
So we strive to try to make it and make it as best we can. But I'll tell everybody out there right now, it ain't a ministry, but it pays like a ministry. There's not a lot of money in it, but we try to do the very best we can and bring some of the coolest people in. We try to change it up a bit every year, and even though we have some of the same staples. And it's become it's a big part of my life, the Paradigm Symposium. I live it and breathe it almost every day, every year. And that's what it's become for me.
Awesome. And who are some of the people attending this year?
Well, this year, we've got Randall Carlson. He's with Sacred Geometry International. And if you've interviewed him, some of your listeners are going to know who he is.
I've had him on a few times. I was actually pushing him on you a little bit.
Oh, fantastic. That's right, early on. But he's, as your listeners know, he's a third-generation professional builder, but he's an active Freemason for the last 35 years. He's mastered some of the oldest and largest lodges in Georgia. And he is somebody that really has a kind of the same goal that we do. He strives to bridge this gap between our archaic systems of knowledge and modern science. And so he is a very, very interesting man. And he's going to be here this year. He was here last year with we had Graham Hancock here last year, and Randall was traveling with him.
Yeah.
They had just done a big tour of the Northwest United States.
Yeah, Randall was showing him some of the evidence of the massive flooding out there.
That's it.
Yeah.
And so he was here just hanging out last year. And, you know, if you don't know what he looks like, folks, he's looks like Grizzly Adams.
Yeah, that's exactly what was going to come out of my mouth.
Yeah, yeah. You think, do you wrestle bears in your spare time? And so he'll be fun to have. We have Richard Dolan is coming, and everybody knows Richard Dolan, the ufological world.
Sure.
And of course, he is somebody that told me, and you probably heard him say this, he said, I didn't get into this to be a ufologist. He says he's a historian and a researcher, but this is where it has taken him. And this is, of course, he's become really one of the world's leading researchers and writers on the subject of UFOs.
And he's moving more into conspiracies now a little, too.
He is. And so he's going to be interesting this year. We've got as our keynote speaker is Lon Milo Duquette.
I just heard him recently and was really impressed with his stuff.
He is somebody who can, he talks about occultism and Western hermeticism in a way that it's like he infuses it with comic flair, and he's got a very approachable persona. And he's also a musician, and so he brings all of that to the table. And he's an American writer, he's a lecturer, a musician, an occultist, Western hermeticist. He is the Archbishop of Ecclesia Gnostica. I could say this really fast if I had practiced it. Ecclesia Gnostica Catholica.
Right.
It's the blah, blah, blah. It's the ecclesiastical arm of the OTO. And he brings stuff about magic, about hermeticism, about the occult. And in our circles and your listenership, I'm pretty sure they don't wrestle too much with the word occultism.
I would hope not at this point.
It's not Satanism.
Hidden knowledge.
It's hidden knowledge. Exactly. And so he is going to be an amazing speaker. He's going to be our keynote this year.
That's awesome.
And we have Travis Walton. If most people know of him, if you saw the movie Fire in the Sky, which, oh my God, came out almost 20 years ago.
Yeah. And so Travis says was pretty much nothing like what happened to him.
Yes. I was interviewing him once and I said, and then there was that scene where you stumbled off the craft or whatever they deposit, and you were naked outside. He goes, I was not naked. and he laughed about that. But he is bringing along with him the producer, and I do not remember her name off the top of my head, but the producer of his new documentary, Travis.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to be screening that on Friday night at the Paradigm Symposium. Peter Robbins will also be here, who is one of the producers as well.
Yep.
But
yep.
Peter Robbins, you know, wrote the book Left at Eastgate about the Rendlesham incident.
Oh, sure. Peter lives here. So.
Oh, there you go.
He lives so, 5 minutes from the studio.
Nice. So you've probably had him in a few times.
Quite a few, yes.
And so Peter is going to be here as well. We've got Barry Fitzgerald from Ghost Hunters International fame.
Nice.
He's the Irishman who was the head of that team. And the neat thing about Barry is while he claims the Ghost Hunters connection, because it's where he garnered a lot of his notoriety, if you will, in these circles, he says, in his Irish accent, he says, I'm so much more, he says, than a ghost hunter. He is quite a researcher. He is one of those that, he's got 20 years of experience in the world of the supernatural. He is one that goes out and looks into the natural mysteries. He's like William Butler Yeats, the poet laureate of Ireland some 100 years ago, was a firm believer in the fae, the fairy realm, and the spirit world, and Barry is as well. And he goes and he researches a lot of that. And so he's the guy that will go up in the caves in Ireland and spend overnight in the caves and just try to absorb it and research it and study it.
Nice.
His new books are like the Council of Three and the Clandestine Shadows. This is the stuff he writes about.
Huh.
So it'll be very interesting with Barry. He was here last year as well. We've got Thomas Fusco.
Yep.
Who everybody knows, he's a researcher, a theorist. He developed the theory of everything.
Yes.
And if you've ever talked to Thomas, he knows it. And he's a down to earth but very intricate thinker.
Yeah.
And so it's always good to have Thomas here. This will be his actually his third year here.
Hmm.
of course, Micah Hanks. Everybody knows Micah Hanks. He's going to be here. He co MCs the show with me, and he helped develop this thing. And we all know him from the Graylin Report, the Micah Hanks Show, his different books. He's a futurist, and also, as he calls himself, the mouth of the South.
Right.
And we've got Rita Louise, Dr. Rita Louise. She's coming back this year. She was here the first year. And she's written books like Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods, Avoiding the Cosmic 2x4, The Power Within, things like that. And she just wrote one on, I can't remember, mythology, something about man and mythology. So she'll be here. My good friend Dan Madsen will be here. I don't know if you've ever talked to Dan
Madsen. No, I'm not familiar.
But he is a friend of mine for about 35 years. I've known this man. And he got his start by publishing in Xeroxed form in the late 1970s the Star Trek Official Fan Club Newsletter.
Nice.
And he was noticed by Gene Roddenberry, the man who created Star Trek, and Paramount Studios. He forged a friendship. Roddenberry would slip him all this inside information about what would be going on with Trek. And then he was given the first licensure by Paramount to do the Official Fan Club Newsletter plus the Star Trek Communicator magazine. And off of that, his contacts, he says, I have been a blessed man with contacts. Steven Spielberg George Lucas got a hold of what he was doing, and he started doing all the fan magazines for Lucasfilms, for the Indiana Jones franchise, for the Star Wars franchise. And one of the last things he did was the Lord of the Rings franchise magazines. And so he became a mogul in this. And I invited Dan to speak the first year, and he said, I don't know what I'd speak on. And I said, you speak on, we're all drawn to these fields that we're in because we're curious about them when we're kids and we grow into this. And I said, you just took it in that slightly different direction. You went to the kind of the fanzine side of things, but you're still just as much engrossed in this. And so Dan Madsen will be there. He is a fantastic speaker, good friend of mine. And by the way, he is he has no qualms about me mentioning this. He's not sensitive about this at all. He's a dwarf. And what really gave him the most confidence in his young days, he's about my age, so he saw Star Trek in its a little bit in its original run and then in its reruns when he was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
It was a dwarven character, a dwarf actor, whose name I can't remember, that had a huge impact on Dan's life in a Star Trek episode that he was in.
Nice.
And that's what really made some big changes in Dan. And he is, I would say, one of the... And by the way, he has... One of the largest, I think, private collections of Abraham Lincoln memorabilia and artifacts in his home in Denver.
Nice.
So he's quite the guy. If you ever want to talk to a good man for a radio interview, Dan is just on top of it all.
Hmm.
Then we've got Edward Nightingale coming. And Edward Nightingale was his first year. He came last year, gave a presentation on the Giza Plateau. Now, there's so much information out there on the Giza Plateau. You think, what could possibly be new? But he has gone into the deep mathematics and architecture of the Giza Plateau. And it is a very interesting topic, and he's expanding that for this year. He just kind of hit it kind of cold and kind of wet last year, and this year he's going to be really developed for this. And it'll be a fantastic presentation. Yeah. Nick Redfern is going to be here. Everybody knows Nick Redfern.
Yep.
The prolific Nick Redfern. We like to say in the time it takes to talk about him, he's probably pumped out another 72,000 words. So Nick will be here. He's been a staple for us. We've got Laird Scranton. He's a linguist. He's a researcher. He's a cosmologist, ancient cosmologist, an author. We all know about his books on the Dogon.
Yep.
And the Pyramid Code and different series he's been associated with as well. So Laird will be here, a phenomenal friend of the Paradigm Symposium, he and his wife, Risa.
Yes.
We've got a newcomer is Sarah Soderlund. Now, Sarah is with the IPBN Alternative Talk Radio Network. She is Also, a good friend of mine, she used to go by the moniker Paranormal Sarah, a medium, and did mediumship work at some of the events and things like that. But the interesting thing about Sarah is she is also she's right now in her doctoral candidacy for forensic psychology. And she has a show called Mysteries of the Mind on our radio network, and she is just a phenomenal, phenomenal thinker. And she starts to tie the forensic paranormal stuff, psychological stuff in with the paranormal, and it makes her a very interesting mix. So we've got Sarah coming. Then we've got coming is Rocky Stucci. John and I do the Situation Room radio show with him every Thursday afternoon at 3 p.m. Central, where we dig into heavy politics and world events. We like to say it's taking a bite out of the ass of the matrix of geo-global politics. Rocky also has his own show, the Special Report, and he is a paranormalist. John and I have had some interesting forays with him into the paranormal. I got to tell you about one of the things that happened with us, and if we have time, I'll tell you about it in a little bit, just off the scale, at an old house which I would declare haunted.
Was this the incident in the basement?
Yes, with the big bang.
Yeah, people can find that if they go to wheredidtheroadgo.com and search for John Ward's interview. There's the videos and everything
fantastic.
Are up.
All I will say is we're standing in a quiet, empty house. I mean, empty, nothing in it. And bang, just hits from upstairs. And I'm sitting on the stairway, and I look up, and I say, hello. I said, upstairs, kitchen. And we go running. We weren't born yesterday. We didn't fall off the paranormal turnip truck yesterday. We know all the things to look for, and we're pretty smart about it. And there was nothing that could have made that noise. And then we picked up some wild EVPs from guys talking to us in French to all in that night. And it was just crazy stuff. And, of course, that's where – and I can't say it on the air, I don't think, but the very famous John Ward utterance – as you're hearing this recording and we're all scrambling up the stairs, John Ward says, get me out of this blanking house. So we like to give him some crap about that. And, of course, John Ward is going to be here. And if you don't know John Ward by now, John Ward and his wife, Dr. Maria Nilsson, they have the quarries of Gebel El Silsila, south of Luxor, Egypt, on the Nile, the old ancient quarries from pre-dynastic times all the way up to the Greco-Roman times. And they've just discovered, as you know, this last March, a new temple that is there on that site. It's been leveled, of course, but they've found stratas underneath and identified just some amazing stuff at that temple site. And that made all the archaeological news. Yeah, and John, of course, wrote the Exodus Reality with me. We've got The Lost Armies of Cambyses is a book that we've got in the works. It's more than in the works, but it's out there. And we've got a new book that we're working on together on history trippers. And so it's a little more light fare, but it's something that
history trippers.
It's not out yet. It's called The 10 Most Adventurous Places to Go in Egypt, from the journals of the history trippers. And that's us, of course.
Interesting.
And so it's a book that we didn't originally want to do. We said, what? The 10 most interesting, please. We're a little above travelogues. And don't think us arrogant when we say that. It was just like, oh, come on. We've got The Lost Armies of Cambyses here. We've got these other books. Why would you want the 10 most adventurous places in Egypt? And so we decided to do it, and I think it's going to be a lot more than people might expect. It's not just a simple travelogue book. So it's going to be pretty interesting. And History Trippers, of course, comes from the title of the television series that is being still out there, very much alive, being presented. And we have some big networks that are very interested in that show. And this is in a sense to brand alongside of the potential television show.
Nice. I didn't know you were doing a television show.
We are. It's actually, we've we've called it History Trippers. And it's kind of funny. We were approached by our agent a little over a year ago. And I had just come back from a month in Egypt, spent with John, and we took some people out there. Then I spent time at Gebel El Silsila, and I came home, and she was very interested in getting us to respond to a couple of producer fellows from who had done some shows with A&E, and they had seen us and were very interested in asking us if we'd be willing to put a television show together. And so we developed a little proposal. Excuse me, I did not hit my mute button. And we proposed 26 episodes traveling up and down the Nile in Egypt.
Nice.
And then we were told, oh, they're a little afraid to just go to Egypt, and can you spread it out? And so it's 26 episodes doing world, different places, world mystery, and it's kind of a buddy on the road archaeologist, historian, and this is what we do.
Nice.
So that's in the works as well.
Okay.
And I just want to mention that we only have two more speakers I didn't mention. We got James Swagger, another Irishman. He does a lot of megalithic work in Ireland, and he'll be here. And Jessalyn Wildflower Devereaux, she's representing kind of the softer, gentler side of the Paradigm Symposium with her shamanic practice presentation and talking about stuff like that.
Nice.
Which I'm not. And, of course, we have Jim Harold from the Paranormal Podcast who's going to be here emceeing all of our panel discussions.
Cool.
And so as long and drawn out as that gets, those are the speakers that we have coming this year. And it's going to be a phenomenal event.
Absolutely. And that's October 1st through 4th. In Minneapolis.
Yes. And it's at the Crown Plaza. If you go to the website, it's just simply paradigmsymposium.com. And go to the website, and you'll see how to get all the passes. There's day passes available. There's also the weekend pass. And then there is what we're calling the masked VIP cocktail party and banquet. And people are a little confused about it. It's not a masked ball. It's just we thought for fun, for the cocktail portion, we do masks. You know, you can wear a mask, you cannot wear a mask, but it's just for fun, and it's the VIP cocktail party. It's brushing shoulders with everybody that's a speaker, uptight and personal, and it's the big banquet after that. So there's those three different passes. Day passes, if you come individual days, the whole weekend pass, and then the banquet pass. And you can see all those, and then way at the bottom of the front page, the Crown Plaza link. It's the Crown Plaza Mall of America. It's 5 minutes. If you're coming from out of town and flying in, 5 minutes from the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport and 5 minutes from the Mall of America. And it's all right there, and we'll all be self-contained right in the Crown Plaza. And if you're local to the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, you can come and get day passes or come and get weekend passes. You can stay at the hotel or just drive in every day.
Nice.
It's right down the big strip by the airport. So,
how soon before you do one in like Buffalo?
Buffalo.
Maybe Albany.
We might be doing it, and all I can say, we might be doing it in another country next year.
Really?
Let's just put it this way: there has been some talk with an institution that would like to sponsor this whole thing and do it in another country next year.
I can leak it.
Might be in England next year.
Well, that's really interesting. That'll get you a whole different group of people who will be able to go much easier.
And that's very certain. So we might do one here as well. We don't know. We're just up in the air. We always like to make it through this year's event before we start planning next year's event.
Sure. Now, as you already said, you're working on a new book, but of all the times I've had you on, we've never discussed your first book.
There's a first book and there's a very first book. My very first book was The Rollicking Adventures of Tam O'Hare I wrote and illustrated.
Okay.
But that's not the book you're talking about. You're talking about the Nephilim, the rise and fall of the Nephilim.
Correct.
Yes.
And when did this come out?
That came out February of 2012.
All right.
And so it's been out a little over 3 years. and about 3.5 years. And it's a book that's really a culmination of a lot of thinking I had done over 30 years of time. Back when I was in seminary, I went to Bible college and seminary, and not to mislead anybody, because there's critics out there who say, how can you teach anything? You are not academically credentialed. And that is the honest to God truth. I have no academic credentials from an institution of higher learning. However, I did attend 3 years of Bible college with no degree. Then our church started a small seminary, and the president of the seminary said, come on board at the seminary. We'll start working on your master's degree, and we'll tutor you in those remaining 18 credits, I think it was, to get my bachelor's. Hmm. And so I went for 2 years. We never really dug too deeply into the tutoring, and I got 2 years toward my master's, but then never finished anything. And I went into advertising. So there you go. But way back in my seminary days, I would ask questions about the Nephilim.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a very fundamental conservative Baptist setting in my schooling. And there was this verse in the book of Genesis that I didn't know what. How do we figure this one out? It says, and the sons of God came down and intermingled with the daughters of men and had children by them. And the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward. And that whole text, and it's really that four-verse segment of Genesis chapter 6 is just the preamble to the Noah and the Ark story. It's the right. introduction to the story. And so I would ask, who are these sons of God? Who are these guys that came down and intermingled with, it says, the daughters of men? And I was told, the explanation I was given, there's a lot of weird theories out there, but, this is really, it only means it's the sons of the aristocrats who built the school of the prophets, and they literally came down out of the highlands and into the valleys and slummed with the common women. And so it was man on woman. And I said, that's it? I said, now wait a minute. In systematic theology here, you teach us that language means something. So the original languages that these passages were written in mean something. And when you look at the language, when you look at ancient texts, you've got to do many different things. Number one, you got to see the language it was written in. You've got to see to whom the context was being written and what in context those people to whom it was written would have understood. And so I said, now, if language means something and it's important, then why does the passage in the Hebrew state that it is the sons of God, the Bnei HaElohim, came down and intermingled with the daughters of Adam? I said, there's a stark contrast, Elohim versus Adam. I said, why didn't they just say it would be the Bnei HaAdam and the daughters, I can't remember the Hebrew for the daughters of Adam, if it was just men going down to women? And I was told very politely that, well, you know, you better watch yourself talking about that stuff. You know, just I'd keep that quiet. And I had one professor there that gave me kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge on that. But his name was Dr. Charles Ayling. And Charles Ayling, now since those days back in 1981, 82, when I was going to school there, he has since become the chair of history at the University of Northwestern. He's been there for almost 30 years. He is also the president of the Near Middle East Archaeological Society. And he's about as academic as you can get and still be – it's kind of funny. He said to me, he says, Scott, I love your book and I love your theories. He says, but, because you're not credentialed, I had asked him to write the foreword to our book, and he said, I can't because of my position with me, because you're non-credentialed and so on. And I said, I understand that. And he said, I'd love to, but I can't. And the interesting thing, though, is he is somebody who holds to a very biblical filter. He once told me, he says, Scotty, he says, never forget that all of your information, you have to filter through the Bible. And I said, but Doc, I said, if I'm doing that, I said, what if the historical information controverts the Bible? And he says, well, then there's my answer. You've got to filter it through the Bible. then obviously the Bible is right because this is what we believe by faith. Now, it's interesting to me that you can have that kind of a religious view and be an academic when you can't believe there are UFOs or ghosts and be an academic. You know that's yeah. There's, and I'm speaking in generalities, but so anyway, Dr. Charles Ehling was a big influence on me in my early days, and I really credit him. He was also an archaeologist. He had been to Egypt back then, excavating on the tomb of Ai in the Valley of the Kings. He wrote the book Egypt and Bible History. And so he is quite the scholar when it comes to this and had a great influence on the direction I took things. But all that to say is from that point forward, the Nephilim have been a topic of study and research, not active. You know, I went into advertising and I was in ministry for a while. I was a youth pastor for several years alongside of being a creative director in advertising. And I kind of drifted away from the faith and drifted away from that those circles. And but the Nephilim were always a big question for me. And then I started seeing in recent, 15 years or so, all that information, how the Nephilim start to get correlated with it, with ancient aliens or ufology or the Anunnaki and all of these things. It's like Anunnaki and Nephilim, which are historical things, have somehow been morphed into these catchwords that if you hear the word Anunnaki, you don't think, oh, ancient Sumerian culture and cuneiform tablets. You think, oh, gods who came down and bred slave races out of humans. And so I wanted to look into this and write about it. And there are even things in that book that I wrote really 4.5 years ago is when I wrote it. It was published about 3.5 years ago. And there are things I would rewrite now. There are things, evolutions of thought.
Right.
Since I wrote that, there are things I missed that, it wasn't an exhaustive research campaign that I conducted, but it was really writing the book based on the things that I knew and understood, had researched and along the years. And one of them was really digging into this story as Hebrew religious mythology. And that was the way I had to do it. I said, folks, I have to step outside the box of any faith structure with this, and I have to look back at it and say, yes, it's a biblical story, but how does it match up with other stories from other cultures? That's the way I approached it. And it's been an interesting book. I said, I will equally draw criticism from Christians, from Jews, from scientists, from academics, from scholars and skeptics alike, and sure enough, it's done that. But it's been a pretty good book. It's had some legs.
Were you able to find correlations in other cultures to the?
I was indeed. I was indeed, and some of them are looser correlations. But this story, as I mentioned to you earlier, and as many of your listeners probably already know, the story of the Nephilim is really the preamble to the flood story.
Right.
And when you look at it in the biblical context, there were things, and I'll get to how it relates to some other cultures here, but there's things we were taught in. Did you, by the way, did you go to Sunday school when you were a kid?
No.
Okay, you did. So so you were a heathen from the beginning. I got it.
Yeah, pretty much.
But if anybody thinks back to Sunday school or synagogue, we were taught what about the flood? That it was God waging judgment on mankind and the earth for the wickedness of man. And that there was only one righteous man, and that was Noah and his family, and they were saved along with two of every animal. We know the story from there. It becomes very mythical from that point. And so I wanted to look at this story and say how many different cultures had stories like this. Is this really what the context says? Because once I found that there were these non-terrestrial beings, these Elohim, who came down and intermingled with human women and bequeathed an offspring, and that this was the reason for the flood, I thought, why is this? And so I started digging into that and found that Noah, where it talks about him, and this is where I got ran into some very heavy criticism, and I don't care that there's heavy criticism. Because, you know, while I may not be right about a lot of things, and there's other people with a lot of theories, and I'm just adding another apple to the cart, when you start parsing ancient language and looking at what these texts said, it's pretty straightforward. Interpretation is a different thing. So what the context of the story was, it talks about Noah being a chosen because he was the righteous man, which is true according to the story. Now, everything I'm saying, by the way, keep this header above your, you know, above everything I say, in accordance with the Hebrew story, right, the Hebrew mythology, all right? And so Noah was a righteous man, but it also has this phrase after it. It says, he was a righteous man who was pure in all his generations. And I always wondered what that meant, and I started digging into that. And what I found was that it was a story of the Nephilim. Doesn't begin in chapter 6 of Genesis. It begins back in the Garden of Eden. And this Edenic story where God creates man and woman, puts them in the garden to till the ground, keep it for him, and lo and behold, the serpent character comes along and beguiles Eve, tempts her, she eats the forbidden fruit, gives it to Adam, and poof, they're both naked all of a sudden. I always wondered why. What's significant about that? Why, at the fall of all of mankind for all the rest of time, according to the Hebrew story, was the first thing you notice about eating the forbidden fruit was you're naked.
Mm.
And there's sexual connotations running through this whole thing. And what I believe you've gotten, it's established in the story, in the language. Nakash, of course, the serpent character, of course, is translated as Nakash in the Hebrew text. And serpent is Nakash. And there's a definition for Nakash. Nakash is the bringer of knowledge, the illuminator, the bright shining one, the bringer of chaos. And by chaos, I don't mean in that negative evil sense. He was that bringer of chaos in that it turned the world upside down.
Mm.
It changed things. He changed things dramatically. And this is the character. The serpent, the name Satan, Lucifer, the devil, wasn't even part of the Jewish lexicon,
right.
Hebrew lexicon when this was written. And it was another 1,000 years before the serpent was even closely at all associated with a satanic character. And so you've got this character who's the illuminator, the bringer of knowledge. I thought, what the hell? That's not Satan. That's not the Satan we were taught existed. And so you look into this, and then it talks about how all the verbs and the verb phrases are very generic in the Hebrew text in the Garden of Eden story, but it says that the serpent, Nakash, beguiled Eve. He drew her in. She took and did eat. These are all terms that are also used in sexual connotations.
Right.
And then it says she gave it also to Adam. Now, according to the story, we don't know what the timeline was from creation to when this happened, but it she gives to Adam, and then she ends up bearing sons. Now, it doesn't say this in the Hebrew passage. I extrapolate this in. Many of your first families of creation throughout many different cultures, always the woman always seemed to bear twins or triplets or quintuplets, or the daughter of the couple did the same, and this is where how humanity spread. But now she has Cain and Abel, according to the Hebrew story. And Cain, I believe, is this, and I believe the passage bears this out. Cain is the son of Eve and Nakash, while Abel is the son of Eve and Adam. And it's borne out through everything that happens in this story in the garden after that. If you remember, once they're naked and God's looking for Adam and Adam's hiding, God curses them all. And he tells the all three of them, he says, there will be constant enmity between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. Or the seed of the humans, I'm sorry. And this is borne out. This is where I think you get the first mention of a splitting of the human bloodline, at least according to Hebrew religious mythology.
Hmm.
And that Cain was really the first of the Nephilim, because he was a son of Nakash, who impregnated him. And Nakash was one of these Elohim, which it doesn't say in the Genesis passage. It calls him, in the Garden of Eden, it calls him Nakash. And one of the key phrases is he's a bright shining one. Now, if you go to Psalm 82 to do a little cross-reference, it's got a picture of God holding court with the divine council, they were called. And they're not angels, by the way. The Nephilim were not fallen angels. The watchers, which were the same as the sons of God, were not fallen angels. It says they were of the Elohim. And God stands in their presence, and he says, and the Hebrew says, and Elohim stood in the midst of the Elohim. And he said to them, you are all Elohim, the bright, shining princes of heaven. And then he goes to pass judgment on them. It's almost got a picture of Zeus and the Olympians.
Yeah.
So I made this statement in the book. I said, I believe that the ancient Hebrews had a pantheon of gods. And you find it right in the Elohim and Elohim himself. And that Jehovah is a very separate character. So go back to this Garden of Eden story. At the fall of man, it says that there's after Adam and Eve had eaten and all of this, it says, and Elohim said, the humans have eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and become just like us. Let us therefore go prevent them from also eating of the tree of life, lest they become like gods. And then he comes down, of course, and curses everybody. Now, what's very interesting, there were two questions that rose for me out of that passage. First of all, I thought, Elohim has a problem with humans gaining knowledge. They ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And I thought, first question, what did God have against humans gaining knowledge?
Yeah.
And then the second point was, if they could eat of the tree of life, second tree, who is God that man could become just like him by eating this fruit? What is that? And of course, it's all allegorical. It's all metaphorical.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started looking into that and finding that every different culture seems to have a story. Well, not every, and speaking in general terms.
Right, right.
Many different cultures out there have in their creation stories the stories of a great or of a spirit beings or non-terrestrial beings that would come down, intermingle with humans, have offspring, and some superior power would want to wipe out that offspring because it was an aberration. And it was usually done by means of a flood, and you find this in many, many, many. There are over 600 different ancient flood accounts that many of them bear some of these striking similarities in their mythology. And so what I saw, I want to back up one thing that I said here, where I said there was a dual seed that was, Cain was the first of the Nephilim because Nakash was one of these bright shining ones, one of the Elohim. And in Genesis 6 it says that the Bnei HaElohim descended to the daughters of Adam and had children by them.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that Nakash was one of the Elohim. He came down and bequeathed Cain with Eve, and then Adam bequeathed Abel with her. And by the way, unless you think that's not a medical reality, it is. I have my own twin daughters that I was told were conceived on at least 10 days apart.
Really?
25 years ago. Huh. Yeah, and I didn't know that was even possible.
Yeah.
Because they said my younger daughter, or younger, I call her younger, Bryn, was conceived. She said 7 to 10 days. She's 7 to 10 days less developed than Abigail.
Now, are they like twins where they're real twins, or...
We always thought they were fraternal, but they're identical.
Really?
They're identical twins. They just found that out just a couple of months ago. My own daughters did some DNA tests and all of that just to find out.
And yet conceived at different dates.
They were conceived on different days.
Wow. That's...
So go figure.
Yeah.
I have no idea how any of that works, so I'm dumb when it comes to that stuff. Really cool. And but I do know it's a medical fact that twins have been, fraternal twins for certain, have been conceived on different days, and which is very interesting. So you look at this now. Here's what I'm going to get at with this, is that I believe, and I don't want to offend anybody's religious or spiritual sensibilities out there, but there was the very first prophecy of a coming Messiah, or in the Greek, a coming Christ, was in the Garden of Eden story. And you ask any rabbinic scholar, any evangelical or Catholic scholar, you're going to get the same answer. The very first prophecy of the coming Messiah was in Genesis 3, where God said to the serpent, "And there will be a day when you will bite his heel, but he will return and crush your head." And it's an enigmatic passage, but they all believe it to be a messianic prophecy. The prophecy of the coming Messiah, and that the coming Messiah had to be somebody who was what the Israelite or Hebrew or Judaic, if you will, sensibility is not the word. Their interpretation of what the Messiah was something they called the kinsman redeemer. And all through Jewish literature and Hebrew religion, Jewish religion is the kinsman redeemer. And the kinsman redeemer was the one who would, if you put it in vernacular, the one who is one of us, redeemer, that would come and redeem mankind from their fallen state, the coming Messiah. And what's interesting is from the point of Adam onward, the Garden of Eden, there's this prophecy of the coming Messiah, that he would someday come, and he would come as one of us, as a human being, as one of the human race, but still fully God, the Redeemer. And you see all through the genealogies through the Old Testament, all through the history, I think, and this is where I don't want to offend anybody's sensibilities, but I almost believe that the story of the Messiah was one that was conceived to piggyback the story of race divided. Because every time you see the mention of the Messiah, the one that would come to be one of us, it's obviating that there's the opposite of that, the one who is not one of us.
Right.
The other side of that story. And all through the genealogies, all you have is this line. You got 13 chapters of it in the Old Testament of So-on begat So-on and So-on begat So-on. Mm-hmm. And it traces the line of Adam all the way up to Noah. And then Noah to Abraham, Abraham to David. And then suddenly the coming Messiah had to also sprout from the seed of David, the king. And so he had kingly authority in Israel. And from Mary and Joseph in the New Testament, they're both distant cousins. They trace both their lineages back to David and then back to Adam. And the reason they do this is to establish that the Messiah had to be one of us, the true, pure-blooded human. And the problem with that, or not the problem, the opposite side of the story is that the Elohim came and the Elohim divided the bloodline, the human bloodline. And so Cain was part Elohim, part human. And this is why they have the story of the flood being to wipe out the evil. When we learned in Sunday school and synagogue, they said the flood came because of the wickedness of mankind. Well, what it actually says in the Hebrew, it's the wickedness brought to mankind. And that's pointing directly to the split blood race. And it's supposed to be something that says that race needed to be wiped out so the Messiah could come from pure human blood. And this is, by the way, where I've gotten criticism from people saying, "Oh, you're promoting that racism because you're talking about pure human blood versus non-pure human blood. That's racism." I was being told by these critics of what I was writing.
I don't understand how that's racism.
Well, they said, "Well, there is things like one of the things brought up was the Christian identity movement, and I even brought that up in the Reptilian book." The Christian identity movement, founded in the 1920s, it's really a white supremacist group, and they go back to the serpent seed doctrine, which states that the serpent or Satan bequeathed this line through Cain, and that it was the line of Cain that eventually produced the Jews, and, you know, they're the evil in the world, and so on. But I said, now, wait a minute. And they were comparing me to somebody promoting Christian identity theory. I said, well, now, wait a minute. I don't promote that at all. I said, you can start at the same foundation and end up in two very different places. It doesn't mean that they're both congruent with each other. I said, in accordance with the scriptural story, the line of Cain was wiped out in the flood. And but there's still that little caveat. It says the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, it says. And you've got even Goliath, the big story of King David when he's a young man and he kills the giant Goliath. And it says Goliath had three brothers in the city of Gath, and they were all sons of the Nephilim, they were called in the Old Testament scripture. So it's very interesting stuff. But all of this says to me that there is a much deeper story, that the story of creation is an encoded message for race interrupted. Now, how you interpret that, you could say the biblical story, I believe it by faith, and I believe that's, you're welcome to believe that. But I also think there are other explanations out there. And in the book, I actually covered a look at the whole ancient extraterrestrial theory. Does this talk about being a race seeding the earth and so on? We don't know for sure. All we know is there are these different theories that are out there. So I present them in the book. And but this is where it gets its start, is in that story right there.
So let me ask you this. Do you think the flood is time-wise connected to whatever happened at the end of the last ice age?
I think it probably is. Here's the problem with all of this theorizing, is that, and the danger we get into when you start grabbing a theory like this and talking about it, as you can tell, if you don't say at the end of every sentence, in accordance with Hebrew religious mythology, that's why I said that at the beginning, you know, this is kind of the header you have to put this all under. There's this danger of coming across like, I believe this is the theory of how things happen.
Right.
I don't believe it. I present it. I think it's an alternative theory, and I think there's a lot more encoded in the biblical story. So what I really believe about it is irrelevant. But if I was to be put on the spot, I would say I think there is something to the Genesis story, but I think it links – It's more mythology that's been built off of natural events. I think the flood was probably, was it a natural event or was it divinely proportioned to wipe out a race of mixed blood beings on this little dot of a planet in the Milky Way galaxy? Who the hell knows for sure?
Right.
But I think probably most of your flood evidence is evidence that was, I was down with some paleontologists in Texas down in the, I forget what they call it, it's the Pleistocene, is that the way that's pronounced?
I think so.
Pre-Jurassic, way back, kind of your mugwump kind of evolutionary beasts there, rather than your huge dinosaurs. And in this red swath, you can even see it from satellite pictures, runs through Oklahoma and Texas, and this is from great flood deposits.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the guys that was with us was a Christian paleontologist who also believed that the Earth was only 6,000-7,000 years old, and that all of these are from the flood, this deposit. And, you know, we got into some good debates while we were down there. But I believe that, yeah, I think the evidences that we see of a great flood probably came from the Ice Age. I do believe if there was an actual literal flood, like the flood of Noah or the flood of Gilgamesh and many of these other cultures that talk about a great flood, it was probably much more localized in the region. And but there's no way we know really for sure. Interesting thing, there's a new movie that is coming out on Noah's Ark, a documentary of an archaeological team that has gone in. I think you've probably heard the stories before. When I was a kid in the 70s, we saw books by, who was the astronaut, the Apollo astronaut, who had climbed Mount Ararat. He wrote a book called Noah's Ark, I Touched It.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that.
They found what they thought were the remains of a big wooden vessel in the higher crags and the ice cap on Mount Ararat in Turkey. And now they've sent another expedition up there. There's been no news saying Noah's Ark was discovered, so I'm assuming that this documentary probably comes back empty-handed, but gives you a lot of information from their point of view. But it's still a very interesting topic. If we found an ark, if we found the remnants of what the biblical description of the ark was in wood that's been petrified for 10,000 plus years, and you look at that up in the frozen ice caps and find it on a mountaintop, would we believe the story was true? Or went to great lengths 10,000 years ago to make that story look real? You know, what would be our take on it? I think it'd be very interesting to find an artifact like that. But it's like with reptilians. We've got all these artifacts of reptilian-looking creatures from the Mesopotamian culture and so on. But there's nothing that really tells us there were reptilians there. It's mythology. And frankly, the Sumerian cuneiform texts of the Anunnaki don't say anything about reptilians. And so it's very interesting when you start getting into the study of this stuff. The little bits and pieces of junk that we find, artifacts, so let's keep it in a higher tone, doesn't mean a thing. I've seen, I've got a little Egyptian god Min who walks around with a huge, raging erection. And you see him on almost every temple in ancient Egypt. He was a god, the god Min. Does that mean that there was a god with a raging erection that walked around amongst men? Not necessarily, just because you can find him on every temple. So there are probably guys who walked around like that, but not gods.
Right.
So I'm not discounting it. There's a fine line I walk here, because I consider myself to be a believing skeptic in certain things. I have seen, on the paranormal side of things, I've seen far too much to discount the spirit world. I've experienced it too up close and personal. So I extrapolate that over into my historical study and say, I've seen enough, and I know that we don't know enough, and we certainly don't know everything. Science isn't the end all and be all. All science gives us is what we know so far.
Yes.
Up to this point.
And science, unfortunately, also has its own biases and perspectives that need to be occasionally upset and changed around.
Well, yes. I just ran across not long ago a video that I didn't even know existed of a debate I was in back in 2012, summer of 2012, with P.Z. Myers, if you know who P.Z. Myers is. He's a crusading atheist, a skeptic. He is a professor of evolutionary biology at the University of Minnesota. And he and an archaeologist were pit against me. And at the last minute, a friend of mine, Jim Johnson, who publishes the Ghost Hunters Tap Sparrow magazine, was grabbed because he was a friend and he was standing there. Hey, you want to come and sit with Scotty on this? He's the only guy on that team. And so we were having a debate. And I actually said to PZ, I said, you know, science isn't the end all and be all. We don't know everything there is to know. And I would get people laughing and jeering at me, of course. He had a lot of audience. There were about 350 people in that audience. And they were jeering me an awful lot. They were respectful to a point. But we ended up with, even PZ had to admit, he said, if there were aliens and we knew of aliens, he said, the scientific community would be the first to want to be there and finding more about it. He says, I just don't think, and he was against the whole notion that ancient aliens bred us and things like that from a biological standpoint. But he also isn't right about everything. He isn't right about everything.
Well, sure, nobody is.
So it's interesting, this whole science versus alternative debate that goes on out there.
Yeah.
And I don't know where we were taking that from in the initial question. But there we are. Okay. That's where it ended up.
So who do you think the Elohim were? Do you think they were extraterrestrial, or do you think maybe they were just another race here on Earth?
I think that the Elohim, in accordance with Hebrew religious mythology, were the divine council. There's a lot of debate on were the Nephilim or the Elohim, the sons of God, as it mentions them in the English, also known as the Watchers in the Book of Enoch, the same characters, were they angels? But they're not called angels anywhere in the biblical account.
Hmm.
The word for angel in the Hebrew is malach, and the plural is malachim, and those words don't appear anywhere. However, you do have Elohim, which is the name, the same word that's used for the name of God in the Old Testament almost 3,000 times. And it's a word that can be used singularly and plurally. Singular version is Elohim. It means God, a singular God with a multiplicity of majesty and power. That's where the heme is the Hebrew suffix to denote plurality. So El being the name of God, Elohim, God among many gods is what that literally translates. And when it's the Elohim, the group, when it talks about the sons of the Elohim, the sons of God, the Bene Elohim, simply talking about those who are the children of the God of many gods, or in other words, it's calling them those who are of the God of many gods.
Hmm.
And who they are, in a biblical context, they're not angels. They are, in a sense, sub-gods to the head god, which was Elohim.
Interesting.
But then Jehovah comes along and changes everything. It's a totally different character. So there's interpretations of that. If we're to take it outside of a religious context, does that then negate the whole story of the Watchers and the Elohim and all of this and the Nephilim? If you take it out of the religious context, a religious story is meaningless. So the question comes, did these religious stories, are they the truth or the foundation and everything else derived off of them, or is there an older story of which all the different religions created their versions of the story? And what's very interesting is that you see the characters mentioned in the Garden of Eden story, which was written by, without getting into a half-hour talk about it, I believe it was written by Moses. I believe Moses was an actual person. He wrote the first five books of the Bible. He codified the Jewish religion right around the 1400 BC. But he wrote about this. The problem is that the story he writes about, like with the Garden of Eden story, it's a mix of ancient Mesopotamian religion. Even the names, you have Enlil, who is the chief god of the Anunnaki, according to the cuneiform texts of the Mesopotamian culture, almost 2,000 years earlier than the writing of the book of Genesis. But Enlil, also known as Elil, with the transmission of humanity from the Euphrates River Valley into the Canaanite region, and they took with them their religions, Elil becomes El of the Canaanite culture, or El of the Hebrew culture, which becomes El Shaddai, El Elyon, Elohim. You've got his brother God back with the Anunnaki in the Sumerian culture. You had Enki, who was also known as Iyah. And Enki Iyah became in that same, over that next 2,000 years of migration of man and religion into the Canaanite region, Iyah becomes the same base word for Yahweh, which is the Hebrew word for Jehovah.
Hmm.
And so you've got these two gods, these similar names, the names used in the Old Testament. Elohim and Jehovah came from Elil, Enlil, and Enki, Iyah, from the Sumerian culture. But then you also have the story itself, where it says Elil went to Enki, Iyah, and he said, create primeval men to do our work for us, to dig our canals, to till our ground, to mine our resources. And so Enki does this with one of the goddesses, and eventually you've got the king Atrahasis of the city of Eridu, and which you can still go visit the city of Eridu, the site of it anyway, on the Euphrates River. And it was this king who pled to his god Enki to deliver them from bondage, the humans from the bondage to the gods. And it was Enki, as Ea, who rises up out of the great subterranean sea, the great Abzu, and he rises up, and it's one of his favorite places to go with his boatman, his servant, was to boat through the Serpent's Marsh, which was the area outside the backwaters of the Euphrates around the city of Eridu. And the Serpent's Marsh, because of Ea's presence there, became known as Ea's Den. And Ea's Den, of course, the language it eventually became Ea-Den or Eden. And but it was this character who rose up out of the Serpent's Den, delivered the forbidden knowledge of the gods to Atrahasis, the king of Eridu, and Atrahasis and the humans were able to fight the wars against the Anunnaki and win their freedom. And for this, Elil condemns Enki, Ea, and all of his followers to...
And right there, our connection was severed. And it took me quite a while to get Scotty back on the line. And so the live show ended there. But when I was able to finally reach Scotty, I had him just kind of say some final words to finish off his point.
It's just all I was going to talk about was the similarities between those two stories are staggeringly close to one another and down to the details. And so who knows? There must have been an earlier story to both of them, that they are both off of some prototype somewhere. Does that indicate there was extraterrestrial races? Not necessarily, but some story that they both came from. So, or Moses just took it from the Sumerian story. So that's right. Either that simple or it's much more complex.
All right. Well, I apologize for the messy end. I don't think that has ever happened on this show before where we lost connection and we're not able to reestablish it. You know, technology, it happens. Next couple of weeks, we have David Politis on. So, maybe some midweek podcasts, we'll see. But until then, here's Psyche Corporation with Whirring World.
Come in, come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? To perfection. 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Counting. Can you hear?